It's World Laughter Day, but we're talking about some stuff that's serious. Talking to Usman Ali next.
You are tuned in to Black Hollywood Lives. Breaking into
cockroaches in the ratchet. Hand me downs with the patches. Mama put a little money in the mat.
Music's good.
Tell me how to make a silver spoon out of plastic. You can either sink, swim, or be.
So what is his name? We'll know this at home.
Jidenna.
Wow, this is cool, you guys. Hello, welcome to Breaking Into here on Black Hollywood Live. I'm your host, James Law Jr. And we're listening to some new music. I love hearing new things that are out there because not everything's played on MTV. They're only the play videos on MTV. You can follow us, of course, on YouTube and on iTunes under Breaking Into, under Black Hollywood Live. We're there. There's a Facebook page called Breaking Into. Like the page. All good stuff. My guest today, he's a talented actor of stage, screen, video games, movies, voiceover. He's in a few shows you may have heard of, like Veep, series of Most Fortunate Adventures on Netflix, and a new series called Nobodies on TV Land. So he's doing all those things. He's also a playwright. We're going to talk about some of his stuff he's done with that writing. And we're going to talk about what it's like to be a man of color in this industry, because, you know, we're here on Black Hollywood Live. We're going to talk all about it. My friend, Usman Ali.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, welcome.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
My head was shaved a second ago, and it grew back in like 1 week.
We could have been twinsies.
God, I know. And I mean, in 1 week it grew back. It's like, how did my hair grow back so fast?
This is an enviable problem you have.
I know. I shouldn't really complain, can I?
Yeah.
Yes. Now, okay, so you are from Swaziland?
I was born in Swaziland. Yeah, that's
correct. Wow.
Yeah. I lived there for about 3 years. Okay. And then after that, I spent the first 18 years of my life in Africa. So
wow.
I grew up in Botswana, Kenya, and wow. Tanzania. And also spent about a year and a half in Pakistan, which is where my parents are from.
Yeah, yes.
So I went to high school in Tanzania. And then once I was done with that, I came to the States.
Was there a culture shock?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think, you know, what's important is that sometimes people ask me that question and they expect me to be like, oh, you know, the buildings are so big and this and that. That's not the case. I mean, there's this misconception that exists that, you know, African places in Africa are very underdeveloped and whatnot. Yes. I lived in very large cities like Nairobi and Dar es Salaam.
Oh, wow.
But the culture shock was more in terms of like, wow, the, you know, food over here is the portions are pretty large, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or like everybody drinks ice water here, you know, like that. Or like billboards, there's so much commercialization, you know, there's just everywhere you look. So those are the things that sort of took me a while. I also, when I came from Tanzania, I moved to Portland, Oregon.
Okay,
so that
there
was
you go.
A bit of a culture shock in another way, where it was just very homogenous. Lovely people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, I love Portland.
Super, super liberal place, but just very homogenous, you know, very white. So that was a bit of a surprise.
I'm glad you said that. That's actually what I meant by not, because I know people go straight to like, it must be, did you eat dirt for breakfast?
Right.
But Africa, there's very much development. And is it Nigeria that has the third large or fourth largest movie capital?
Nollywood, I think.
Yes.
I think that's what it's called. Maybe it's in Lagos or.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, massive.
So people understand, it's like, there's some stuff going on over there. It's big. And that's what I meant. It's just like, it must be different because our attitudes are different.
Yeah.
How was it for you? Because, I mean, you're Pakistani?
Yeah, my parents are, and that's my ethnicity, right?
But you're African, too, I guess.
I am, yeah. In some ways, I am an African-American.
Yeah,
I'm a U.S. citizen,
that.
And I'm born in Africa and spent my entire life there.
So my question to you is, just the attitudes of when you ran across maybe militant Black Americans who are trying to be African, how did that initially hit you, maybe?
I thought it was... It was a noble thing for them to feel like they wanted to reconnect with their background or wherever they might be from. But sometimes it was a little vague, you know, because there's a lack of sort of actual education into, like, you know, looking into where you are actually from and what it's like over there. And it's always a very interesting relationship between, you know, Black Africans from Africa and Black African Americans. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's still a level of... You know, you're still an American at the end of the day to a lot of African people, you know. So it was interesting. I mean, I've experienced quite a lot of different sorts of people over here, and they're either misconceptions or preconceived notions of what Africa is like. You know?
What do they say when they see you most of the time? What are some of the reactions they think you are?
People think I'm Arab more than anything else.
That.
Do you know what I mean? And interestingly, I came to this country a year before 9/11.
Oh, wow.
So it was a different time.
Oh, I'm sure,
And then right after 9/11, things changed quite dramatically. So there was almost this, I would even say I was, before 9/11, I was almost invisible to people. Like, I was just like this minority didn't really exist. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they didn't know much about me. Some people thought I might be Indian. Some people, okay. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And Indian makes sense because Pakistan is pretty much India, you know, in a lot of ways.
Yes.
But then after 9/11, it became like this. That was, I always say to people that 9/11 is like the birth moment of what my ethnicity is to white people. Like, that's where we were born out of. Ooh, you know,
interesting.
What I mean?
That's interesting. Yeah.
And that's how we were sort of perceived in television and film, too. Do you know what I mean? For so long, for example, black African Americans, you know, slavery is like the defining beginning moment, you know, the birth narrative, quote unquote. And so much what we see in the media was black people being portrayed as slaves and that sort of that journey. And so for us, it's almost like 9/11 and this terrorist attack is this moment where we become part of the consciousness of the United States, and people have this, you know, this idea that's completely, you know, miseducated, I would say, about who we are. And that's why initially those first, well, even right now, you know, how we're shown on television is either as like terrorists or, or those sorts of things.
And you talk about, we're going to talk about some of your work, because you do talk about throughout your work. This is an interesting chain of thought. So you're basically kind of invisible, because in America it's usually like black, white, Latino, that's Asian, right. That's it.
Yeah.
But then after 9/11, it's heightened, obviously. And anybody looks like none of those four people, then you must be a terrorist and a Muslim.
Yeah.
So then coming into this business, so when did you come into this? Did you come in right after that? Or, I mean, was there some time period between then?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I kind of always knew that I was going to be an actor. I mean, or in the arts in some way. I always was interested in doing, like, educational outreach through the arts. That was my whole thing. And that's kind of what took me to Chicago, which is, we can talk about.
Yeah.
I think I always wanted to be in the theater. I wasn't necessarily interested in television and film initially. You know
how funny.
I mean? And so in the theater, there were more opportunities also to play things that weren't about, you know, the political climate that we existed in necessarily, where brown is bad. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, that's where I was, and I was doing that for a long time. I think now as the years are passing along and more people of color are at the table, do you know what I mean? Like, at the writing table,
yes,
at the producing level, things are changing, narratives are changing. You know, social media is allowing people to be, is empowering people to also have an opinion of what they see when they don't, if they don't like something in terms of how it's being whitewashed or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So things are changing, but certainly when I started about, you know, 17 years ago, it was, it was different, you know?
Yeah, because it must be hard for someone, I mean, for someone who's not, in this country especially, who's not black or white.
Right.
Because, I mean, after that, everybody else is, I mean, it's hard for blacks too, but I mean, I think we have it a little easier than Asian or South Asian or, you know, Samoan. I mean, like, just, like there's like, this this whole area that no one, like, talks about. Like, they're after.
Yeah.
And you have to fight against that kind of beginning, especially in the beginning.
Yeah, you know, it's always been interesting, like, certain theaters, for example, they'll do this thing where they're, like, they want to diversify their programming, so they have, like, a play where they collaborate with an African-American theater company or a Latino theater company. And then we're like, so what about us?
Right.
Where we don't fit into those narratives or those stories.
Right.
You know,
you have stories to tell.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, it's constantly a battle for more representation, you know, accurate representation. Mm-hmm. And that battle continues and will continue for a long time. I do think progress is being made. It's incremental sometimes, you know, but it's happening.
Well, I mean, you get people like Priyanka Chopra, who's, you know, lead of a network TV show.
Right.
That doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
Even though we've seen a lot of South Asian and Indian people kind of spread around on shows now.
Sure, yeah.
For a while, there was like, all of a sudden, it was like, oh, that's the person now. Now it's a South Asian all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And then for a while, it's like, oh, now all of a sudden it's a Korean. You know, there's always things that you kind of go through these things. It's kind of cyclical.
Yeah,
weird things.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I just worked on a show for YouTube Red. They're doing their own, like, subscription series.
Yeah, they're doing their own programming. Yeah. Actually,
it's called Lifeline. It's just this sci-fi thing, and we shot about 10 episodes. But on set, there was me, and then there was another South Asian actor, Sankrish Balat.
Together?
And,
oh, my God.
There was two of us.
Oh, my God.
Like, whoa. Like, this is weird, you know? We didn't go for the same role. We're playing two very different roles. We're both, like, major roles on this television show. And there's two of us. And there's no commentary. It wasn't that the story, you know, sometimes a narrative is telling you that, well, we need two of them because the story is about either how they conflict with each other or they're doing something. No, we were two separate storylines, but in the same show. So,
that's,
you know,
amazing.
Incremental progress is happening, right?
Let's show the first clip. Yeah, we've had 5 minutes left. Just kidding. I need something. Like, we're done. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Actually, that was a good conversation so far. So let's show this. This is what I want. This is what I want. This is actually leads right into that a little bit. This is from 2009.
Yeah.
Distilled natural spring alloy alternative green.
Polycultural, polyamorous.
The first multi-tri by mono minded for the first.
Vegan friendly pro-life all choice.
All satellite 24 hour digital to finally run this nation like an assembly line. Is America strong enough, mature enough? Has it healed? Has it lived in a grass hut? Has it been in the Peace Corps?
Denounced its upbringing and grown along with beard.
Has it sang loud enough for the judges? Has it completed the physical requirements?
Can it walk the runway?
Can it lose the weight? Is it ready for the first self-propelled?
Self-medicated.
Self-loaded. Can it handle the impact of a full-fledged, wavering, moderate neutralist with right-wing tendencies and a sympathy for 1960s beach films? Is it ready? I say that America couldn't be more ready. It's a UFO sighting, Miley Cyrus obsessed, fries bucket of chicken, P.T. Barnum and Bailey Circus. Would elect a donut if it promised cheaper gas.
Good pop lock.
Slash burn. Turn the other cheek. Bite off the nose. And disco ball non-stop.
I love that. And that's 8 years ago.
Wow.
Like, literally, this March. So we're in May. That's 8 years ago.
Oh, my God.
When you look at that, what are the first things come to mind?
Oh, wow.
You were smiling and stuff. So what? At least you're smiling, everybody. You're smiling.
Yeah, you know, first of all, I had the chance when I did that to work with two incredible slam poets, and Idris Goodwin and Kelly Zenyi Tsai, who are... Kelly's in New York. Idris is now, I think, in New Mexico, like working as a professor. Okay. And a playwright as well. But just working on that and seeing that now, I'm like, wow. I would be interested to see what we would come up with in this day and age, you know?
Today,
like,
yeah.
Because that was very much, we wrote that piece and a few other pieces together. We had the show called American Ethnic in Chicago, sort of dealing with the idea of ethnicity and lack of representation on television,
yes,
right?
Yes, so yes.
It's interesting that 8 years later, I'm still having this conversation. It's
okay, what a shame, right?
But I see that now, and I just wonder how we would change that up with, you know, living in Trump's
America.
I'd be curious too.
Yeah. It's like I do spoken word, and I just released my first book of poetry. It's on Amazon.
Cool.
I was thank you. I had to be very vulnerable to actually put it on Amazon and like sell the book. It was very interesting. It's been some nice response to it. But I love that form of expression.
Yeah.
I go to the New Yorker Poet Society in New York. I love that place.
Yeah.
And I'm part Puerto Rican and everything, so I love the whole thing. And I just love how you really can get a lot across.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we can, and in one like slam, you're talking, you can make somebody laugh, cry, you know, chortle, you know, get serious, get quiet. I mean, like, I was laughing, I was looking, I was like, plus visually looking at the three of you visually was very interesting.
Right. How interesting, right, to see an African American man, an Asian American woman, and myself as well in there, you know, all together.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, slam poetry for me, when I started doing that in college, and I was working with a hip hop theater collective in Portland, Oregon. Then I went to grad school in Florida, actually, and over there I started up a hip hop collective as well.
Wow.
Yeah, and we used to sort of, you know, collaborate on works in terms of creating lyrics that sort of dealt with the issues that we were seeing as young people of color around us. And I find that sort of work to be incredibly fulfilling for young artists. You know, for me, it gave me a voice, and in some ways, you know, saved me from a lot of things.
Me
myself
too.
From, you know, it just allowed me to have an avenue where I could express myself pretty succinctly too, you know, because that's the thing. It's slam poetry can be expansive, but you get a lot across in like a rhyming couplet. You know, it's Shakespearean in that way as well, because you're getting so much in there, and people are responding to it so differently. But I haven't done that in a while. I used to perform at the Green Mill in Chicago, which is a fantastic sort of, some people say, the birth of the deaf poetry movement, you know, the slam poetry movement.
Yeah.
But yeah, Chicago's a great, great town for that sort of thing. And that's where we did that, American Ethnic.
I just, you know, for me, it saved me also, because I'm a painter, and that's one form that helps bring stuff out. But for some reason, writing something down and choosing how I want to say it.
Right.
I mean, some parts, like, I'm writing it down and I'm angry. I can say it angrily.
Yeah. And, you know, your audience will embrace that. Do you know what I mean? That it's great because it's so freeing, right? It allows you to sort of express yourself without necessarily the judgment. I mean, people will have their opinions, certainly. But it's, you know what it is? The word for me is it was empowering.
Yes.
You know? I needed that at a point in my life, particularly when I felt like I was being marginalized over here, that I needed a way to speak out without harming myself or harming someone. Do you know what I mean?
You just said it, took words out of my mouth.
Yeah.
Because that was for me, too, because there was a time in this business where I just kind of felt like I hit a plateau.
Yeah.
And maybe we can speak about this. You hit a plateau and you're like, they're seeing me just as this black guy.
Mm-hmm.
Or for me, this old guy.
Right.
And like, I'm not going to shave my goatee off. I'm keeping it gray. I'm not going to change it. Mm-hmm. I want to stick with that conviction. But then anger does come in when certain mm-hmm. jobs don't come to you.
Right.
Or, you know, somebody's in Hollywood, they're very blunt. Sorry, you're not black enough. Or you're just, black. Or they'll say things to you. I'm sure you've heard that stuff like that, too. And you have to develop a thick skin, of course. But sometimes it does get to you. And I found that writing it down and getting it out and performing it out and just getting it out...
Absolutely. It's, yeah, you sometimes can't let that stuff fester, you know.
Yes.
I remember I did a short piece on like how there's no, for example, South Asian doctors on any of the doctor shows on TV. Do you know what I mean? Like on Grey's Anatomy or on now the Chicago Med. There's like not a single one. And in the real world, you know, the vast majority of your doctors are probably going to be South Asian.
Mine are, so yes.
You can either let that excuse me.
That's not, hey, that's we're talking real. That's
okay, you can either let that fester or you can let it out and in a creative form.
Yeah.
And that's what it was for me, was allowing myself to sort of get it out, you know, just put it out there.
So let me ask you, so mm-hmm. so as you're navigating, you have a manager and you have people and mm-hmm. work for you and things, so how are you these last couple of years? Like you said, we have a new America these days.
Right.
How's that affected you and your representation and trying to navigate your way? Because you're on a few shows right now. We'll talk about each show and all that kind of stuff, but just in general, how's that affecting your movement in this business?
You know what? I was... smart enough, I suppose, early in my career to make it clear to my representatives what I would do on television and film and what I wouldn't.
Okay, good.
And for me, having that clear line of conversation with them was really important. You know, my agent is like a small Chicago boutique agent, even today, even out here in LA, and oftentimes people are surprised by that. But it's essential for me to have a line of communication with them where they know that I'm a theater actor who's trained, who isn't interested in playing the guy underneath the bus who plants the bomb and blows up a bunch of school kids. And I say that as an example because that is those are things that are often put towards us.
Yeah.
So establishing that early on for me, yes, did I lose jobs and was I broke for a while? Absolutely. And I don't ever judge anyone who takes those roles because... Right. People's personal lives sometimes dictate that we have to.
Yes,
you know, I did an episode of a television show once where I did play one of those kinds of roles, and I regretted it instantly, but at that time, I needed
it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't judge it, but I think it's important to know yourself, know what you're willing to do, and realize that at the end of the day, if you don't take this one, something else will come.
Yeah.
Something else will always come. You just have to wait to find it and be proactive and ready to take it when it does. Do you know what I mean?
I like that. That's true. No judgment to anybody who does the things that we don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, everybody has their own lines they draw in the sand.
Yeah.
For me, it's just figuring out, because you have this conviction of certain things you don't want to do,
mm-hmm.
you have to navigate this business a certain way then.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously. And again, I just have to stress, sometimes it's not important about... You know, there's people like, well, you should be with a really big agency. And I'm like, well, those guys might completely lose track of me. You know, they might be like, well, why don't you want to do this? I don't want to have to go through those conversations again that I've had where it's like, you know, these are the reasons why I am the way I am and what I'm willing to do. So it's important to establish that very early on, I think.
And I want to say out loud to people, small business, there's nothing wrong with small business. I'll say it to every camera. So boutique-y anything is not always bad. Anybody goes to big, like you said, you get lost in the shuffle.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I mean, your people are working for you, I'm sure.
They're working very hard.
Right.
And, you know, and people are, again, very surprised that they're like, so your reps are based out of Chicago? I'm like, well, they have an office in LA, but really, they're a Chicago agency, and they do very well for
them. Nowadays, I feel like with technology and phones and tablets, you don't really have to be in LA or New York.
That's right,
I think you can nowadays.
Yeah, I think
work around it on some level.
Yeah, I think you could certainly, particularly in the beginning, like when I was doing a lot of theater in Chicago, I would do some television too, and it would be out of Chicago or New York, and you know, and I steadily built up a resume of credits. And then when the time felt right, when I had certain momentum, then I came out to Los Angeles, you know. So that worked for me.
I think that's totally fine.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of one of the roles that you do have reoccur on, and show the picture, of course. This is the first one that does this thing is the toothpick. Yeah, that one. On Veep.
That's right.
Okay, first of all, that show is one of the funniest, World Laughter Day. It'll be on tonight. One of the funniest shows on television. the dialogue. I just want to ask, I've interviewed several people from Veepron. I want to talk about the dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's so, you have to listen to it when you watch the show. It's funny.
Yeah.
It's quick. It's, there's like pop culture references in there. It's vulgar in some way. Right. I mean, like, your character's fine. That's how I first noticed you was on there, of course.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was in season 5 and a couple of episodes, and it was a quick introduction of who I am. And I come back now in season 6, which just started airing, and it's a really nice character arc that they've given me for like a few episodes. So I'm really excited for people to see that. It'll start, my episode starts, I think, May 21st or so.
Okay, so coming up this month.
So it's really great. But working on that show, I mean, you know, it was a funny thing. I was a big fan of the show for the longest time. I loved it. I have a couple of friends, we were like, oh my God, it's the best comedy on TV.
Everybody's good on it. Everybody's
great. And so I just had put it into my agent's ear one day. I was like, look, I got to get on this show. I'll do anything on this, you know, whatever small role.
Yes.
And it turned out to be that I was, you know, I got on the show, I got to work with them, and again, these past few months I've been working with them, and it is a fantastic environment because everyone on the show is incredibly smart. Do you know what I mean?
Ooh, yeah.
The writers are very, very smart. You know, the showrunner, Dave Mandel, is like top notch. He's constantly like, he's just, and you know, the thing is, they all work really hard.
I believe it.
You know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus is, she's obviously an icon, but at the same time, she, you know, she'll shoot a scene with you, and then she'll run straight to the cameras and watch the playback, and then she'll have notes for the writers, she'll have notes for the producers, she'll have notes for the scene, you know, and then she comes back and does a scene again. She's very collaborative, which is the other thing. They're all about, like, input. One of the really great things about that show is it's the first time I worked on a show where they almost tell you that, hey, you should overlap. Like, we should really talk over each other.
Oh, they do.
Absolutely.
All the time, yes.
You know, they shoot it in such a way where they're not that concerned about, like, losing your audio or something. So they're like, just her thing that she always says is, hey, we got to zhuzh this up a little bit. Do you know what I mean? And so we get in there and try to make it more natural. Yeah. So it's less TV talky. Do you know what I mean?
I told you.
She's fantastic. So working on that was a dream come true for me. And I'm really excited about this season.
Do you, I mean, okay, because I only imagine, do you guys have a hard time keeping a straight face sometimes when you were doing your scenes?
I did not have such a hard time because I was so focused. I was like, I can't mess this up. You know what I mean? Like, I'm intimidated at first. I mean, working with her, you know, she's so good, you know, and even if you're so confident about your abilities, which I am, I was still like, this is fucking really good. You know what I mean? So
no, I get it.
Yeah, I certainly. But everyone on that show, and what they do is typically they will do the scene once, you know, then they'll say, okay, let's make these adjustments, and then they'll give you alt lines, which is like, hey, this time when you're in the middle of that monologue, throw this joke in there. Do you know what I mean?
Oh my God.
And there were some times where, I remember one night we were shooting and they said, hey, by the way, we have that big scene coming up, so we have to rewrite it. And I was like, okay. And then we sat at the table with the writers, you know, and we sort of like figured out how to write the scene. It turned out very different than what it originally was. And then they're like, okay, let's quickly run it and then shoot it.
So you have to learn it like right on the fly.
Yeah, on the fly. So, you know, and it's surprising when you're under that kind of pressure, your brain just clicks into gear and you can get it down, you know. The next day, I remember I had an audition for something, and they'd give me the lines like an hour before, and I couldn't get them done because I didn't care much. I was like, oh, yeah, this is too soon. You know? But on set, it was like that moment, and I got them because that it's just, sense. You know, you're that invested, and everyone is like, it's like an organism. Everyone's working together towards the same thing. It was a fantastic show to
watch. I get that feeling from it. I do. Just from watching you guys on HBO, it's on Sunday. It's so...
Yeah.
Just the I mean, guess the dialogue is just so good. And it's just so nasty sometimes,
nasty. I mean, and everyone, it's all fair game, right?
It sure is.
They will make fun of everybody and anyone, right?
They do.
It doesn't matter, like, black, brown, you know...
Gay, straight, male, whatever, female, gay, tall, straight, yeah. short. They make fun of everybody. And it's so, but it's one of those shows that I sit down. I was called like one of the Thinking Man show. I just sit down and I want to hear all the dialogue. Yeah. There's some sight gags in there too, a little bit, but it's mostly. And it's funny because it's a very conversational show.
Yeah, sure. And it moves fast.
It moves fast.
Yeah.
But every single person, and I was laughing because I met Matt Walsh.
Uh huh.
And of course, he started UCB here. And he's good. But he's the one who's just, I mean, they're so good.
I know. Matt's really good as well. He's fucking hilarious.
Oh, my God. He's so hilarious. They're all good. I mean, Tony Hale, everybody's just so good. Matthew Robertson. Everybody's just so good on that show. And I just, you were really good on it, too.
Thank you.
Another show that you do. We're going to show part of this clip. I can't remember how long it is. I think I set it up where it should be. Yes. So let's show this and we'll talk about this. This is another interesting show.
Yep.
She can tell you everything you need to know.
Do you live with our Aunt Josephine?
I am your Aunt Josephine. Good morning. I am Stefano.
It is afternoon. Enter Count Olaf.
The only reason why Count Olaf hasn't torn you limb from limb is because he hasn't gotten a hold of your fortune.
He will never get away with this.
Your fortune will be mine.
Carpe diem.
Seize the children.
Seize the day.
I said day.
Another major release, obviously, when this came out, it was just like, it's on Netflix, and you can see it, and you can stream the whole thing, and you're in that. Another major, Neil Patrick Harris, of course, playing Olaf, and of course, it was books, and it was also, so it had its own following. How has that experience been for you?
Crazy. I mean, it's...
With no hand. With
I got the hooks on my hands, and, you know, I've gotten quite good with those, actually.
Really?
I can do quite a lot of things. It's a great show, and I was excited to be a part of it just because I knew it had this huge following, and they were kind of like lining it up with all these really big, you know, producing names like Barry Sonnenfeld is our showrunner, and you know, so, and Neil, of course, is fantastic, but really good. We're in our second season now. I'm actually flying back up to Vancouver tonight to continue the second season. We've got I think a 10-episode season coming up, so it's good. And you know, the fans has been like a trip. You know,
I'm sure they
are so into it.
Is this your first project where you have these cultish fans? I guess the fans, I guess, for you.
Yeah, I think so.
Like really, like the
particularly where a project where I have there's a cult following and I have a relatively large role.
Yeah.
I've done I was in a very small role in like one of the Star Trek films, and even that is like people are like, oh my god, I gotta get your autograph.
I'm sure.
You know, at conventions and things. Yeah. But with this show, they're just, you know, I think there's people have this nostalgic connection to it. All these people who are in their 20s right now who grew up reading the books, you know, and then their kids reading it right now too. Families reading it together. And it's great because it's very dark in some ways, so adults can kind of get into it as well. And then it's still light enough where you can watch it with your kids too. It's been a really, really good experience.
Now, tell me who you play, just in case you've never seen it, who you play in
there. So I'm the hook-handed man, who's also called Fernald. That's his real name, but he's just known as Hooky, kind of.
Yes.
He's one of Count Olaf, played by Neil Patrick Harris, one of Count Olaf's henchmen.
Yes.
And so Count Olaf is constantly trying to get his hands on these orphans who have been given to him, initially wrongly given to him for safekeeping. But he wants to basically kill them so he can get their fortune. You know, they've been left this money. And there's a variety of side stories. And my character, for some reason, has this weird way of like communicating with the baby, who's like an infant toddler, right? Somehow understands what the baby's saying. Yes. You know, it's kooky, crazy, off the wall, but fantastic. And I'm really pleased that we have some diversity on our show as well. You know, there's myself, Alfrey Woodard is fantastic. Yeah. Asif Mandvi from Daily Show.
Yes, I saw him, I was like, oh my god, I love him too. Yes.
Yeah, he was in a couple of episodes playing a great role. And then K. Todd Freeman, who's a Chicago-based, well, actually New York now, theater actor and also done television film, has a great role of Mr. Poe's fantastic banker role, and he you know, so there's us there playing those roles, adding a bit of color to it as well. And you know, going back to that whole conversation about representation, it's happening slowly.
It must be interesting because that's, you know, this one, that's a binge one. That one's already done once.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you're used to doing episodic TV where it's like, it comes out next week.
Sure,
comes out next week.
Yeah.
This one, it's all out at once.
I know. I was just talking to somebody about how different that is, because when the show was about to come out, there was all this hype. Then when it came out, it blew up, and it was this massive thing in January where everybody was watching it. And then once January ended, it was like, hey, so what was the name of that show? You know what I mean? Like, you're like, how do you maintain people's interest on a show when they binge watch it all, you know?
Right.
I don't know what Netflix's formula is for that. I mean, they release so much content. You know?
Because, like, for me, I'm into Stranger Things, and that comes back in October. So I'm like, it does work on some level. I mean, it's like Kimmy Schmidt and Grayson Franklin. They really are reinventing how we watch television.
Yeah. Although I think now some of the streaming channels, like Hulu, for example, they've created their own content.
Yes.
I think that what they're doing is releasing maybe two at a time.
Yes.
Or something, right? Isn't The Handmaid's Tale or
one
of them?
Yes, exactly. So you're doing like a few at a time. You just keep it going. But, I mean, but it's funny. It's still, it's, again, you don't have to wait the next week for the next episode nowadays.
Yeah.
It's a very, I mean, I remember when it first started, I was like, it's not going to work. You guys are crazy. But now it's like, no. Now this is great. You can stand and watch whenever you feel like it.
Yeah.
If you want to fish it all one weekend, then I guess fish it all one weekend, but there's like...
Yeah, yeah. I know so many people are like, so I watched your show today. I'm like, what do you mean? Like the first episode? They're like, no, all 8 episodes. I'm like, 8 episodes? Yeah. They're like over an hour long each.
Yes.
You know? So that's over 8 hours of your life.
Yes.
You put it. So yeah, that's that means... I mean something to them, I suppose, if they're going to, you know, yes, spend 8 hours. But yeah, it's crazy.
Yes, I love that. And what is one thing you could tell us about Neil Patrick Harris that we might be, because there's a lot said about him, mm-hmm, but what's going to be really interesting that we just maybe, that you can share, that you would be surprised by, you think, that you worked with them?
You know what's maybe not surprising, but I was pleased to see, is that Neil is incredibly dedicated to the craft of acting. Mm. Not necessarily, you know, sometimes people see him and they think because he hosts all these award, yeah, shows that he's very like polished and showbiz, but he really gets down to like the core of, wow, the character. Even especially Count Olaf is a character that keeps changing. He has a lot of disguises that he plays, okay, different, yes, roles throughout the episodes. Every time he puts on a different disguise, he really takes his, wow, time to sort of get into it, and it's very rare on a television show where you see an actor warming up, you know, for like we're on the stage, you, yeah, know? So I would see him doing like vocal warm-ups and, yes, physical warm-ups, and I'm like, oh, that's very, that's normal to me because I've done a lot of theater, but, yeah, I don't ever see an actor doing that, wow, on set, especially somebody who's like number one on the show, you know,
yeah,
but he's always like,
but he's also, but he's very theater too, I guess,
yeah,
also,
he,
yeah,
is incredibly, and you, yeah, see that come across and how he's been able to like straddle both worlds almost, yeah, as a performer on screen and also on stage, really, really dedicated to what he's doing. Wow. Yeah.
How are the hooks? Like when they said you're gonna have hooks for hands, right, I mean, like, yeah, how? I mean, you have to wear them all day long while you're. I mean, like, you take it off and like go to the bathroom. And you're like, how does that work?
I get breaks. but they're good, man. I can't give away the magic of them or how they work. Yes. But you know, I put them on. I work with them as much as I can, and they took a while to get used to because they're a little heavy, actually.
Are they heavy? Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh.
They have some weight to them, you know, and they are. I mean, it's metal at the end that I'm.
I guess so. Yeah. So.
Working with, but they're good, and we've got a really great team up there that sort of created all these things for us as well. I get a lot of breaks though. As soon as we cut a scene, I'm like, hooks, de-hooking. They're like,
de-hooking.
You always hear the ADs, all right, time to hook this man up, and then like, all right, de-hook, you know, like you're hearing all the walkie-talkies, copy, de-hooking.
I love it. I love it. A major de-hooking.
Yeah.
I like that. Now let's show the next picture. And this is, yeah, from the set of Nobodies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not, you guys, he's tall in real life. I knew that he's taller than me, and I'm 6 feet tall. And I look at that picture, and I'm going, wait a minute, you are taller than everybody else.
Right.
Okay, so let's talk about Nobodies is produced by Melissa McCarthy and her, that's man, right, Ben
Falcone.
Ben Falcone. And so how did that, and that's on TV Land, and so how did you get involved with that project?
I just auditioned. I mean, it was one of those situations where they held an audition, and I went in. And what was crazy about the audition was they were lines.
Okay.
But I was like, you know what, they are improv people. I can improv, so we're just going to improvise.
Okay, yes.
So when I went in there and playing, you know, I play this network studio executive who's kind of larger than life, thinks very much of himself and,
yes,
and whatnot. And you know, we improvised a scene where they're pitching their show to me.
Yes.
And I just started like riffing into them, you know, like about all kinds of things. I was like, so, you know, how come there's no people of color in your show? Or, you know, and just, I brought in race and all. And the whole time I could hear Melissa in the background like watching the scene and cracking up forever. And what was supposed to be like a 2 or 3 minute audition, yeah, became like a 10 to 15 minute audition.
Wow.
So it felt really great.
Yes.
Of course, when you leave an audition, you never know.
No, you never know.
You're like, okay, I mean, I've been in some where I'm like, that was amazing.
Right, nothing.
Crickets, you know what I mean? So so it was good. It worked out, and they called, and they hired me. And what was really great is that a friend of mine, Toni Newsom, she plays the role of Grace, who is kind of like my cohort.
Yes.
And she went and auditioned right after me.
Oh, wow.
And we know each other from Chicago theater. Okay. And so now we're working together on this show as well on TV.
Yes, that's
so that's
fun.
Always really nice.
Yeah,
you know?
Nice.
And much like Veep, Nobodies and Veep, they both have this huge, wow, Chicago contingent, you know, of actors. Like you mentioned Matt Walsh,
yeah,
and he's from Chicago,
yep,
and Kevin Dunn's from Chicago.
Yeah, I love Kevin
Julia's
Dunn,
from like Chicago,
yeah,
went to Northwestern.
Yeah.
You know, Gary Cole, those are all the Veep
all
people.
Good.
You know?
Yes, they're all so good.
And then
too.
On Nobodies, Melissa McCarthy,
yes,
like she went to, I think she went to Northwestern, but I know she's from,
yeah,
Chicago or spent some time,
yeah,
there too. And then Tawny and myself. So it's interesting, a lot of these comedy shows have that sort of Chicago element.
What's interesting,
I'm very proud of.
You're bringing it up. It's funny because we all think New York,
mm-hmm,
and LA.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you may think Atlanta because people know Atlanta's a major hub now,
right,
for stuff. But Chicago really has always had,
yeah,
a large amount of people coming out of there that are,
yeah,
that permeate the comedians,
right,
you know,
right,
writers,
yeah,
producers,
yeah,
actors.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I think Chicago, first of all, has a great improv scene, right? Okay. So they've got Second City and yes. Improv Olympic that all started in Chicago. So they have that going for them. And a lot of comedy writers and whatnot end up going to SNL and stuff like that from Chicago. And that's been historically the case.
Yeah.
But also the great thing about Chicago is that there's a fantastic theater community out there that exists where really good new plays are being developed all the time, workshopped right from like the beginning. You know, I had a couple of plays that I did that, you know, one of them was called Disgrace that ended up winning a Pulitzer Prize. I was in another one that we started in Chicago called The Elaborate Entrance of Chad Deity that was a Pulitzer finalist when we took it to New York. So there's almost like this incubator sort of environment over there. And as actors, because some of the houses are so small and intimate and there's so much importance put on being a good professional, like in LA you do a play and if something else comes up people are like, peace, I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. You can't do that in Chicago. Once you're committed to a show, you're committed to that show. They don't care if there's something else comes up, you know, they contractually write you in.
Right.
So there's this thriving scene where actors learn how to be working actors. Mm-hmm. You know, in New York oftentimes I have some really talented friends who are out there and they keep trying to get gigs, but it's a bigger pool, so they're not, you know, you become a professional auditioner. Do you know what I mean? As opposed to a professional working actor. And in places like Chicago, there's the scene is big enough where you'll be noticed nationally if the show does well. And it's small enough where you still have the opportunity. There are opportunities available to you because you're not playing against so many more people. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So I think it's a lot there. I mean, Tracy Letts is a fantastic. Yes. You know, he came out of Chicago. The whole Steppenwolf scene. So it's a good place. And I often say that a lot of my success that I'm having right now is directly linked to my experiences in that city as an actor.
And also apparently linked in terms of who you're working with these days. Just happening. It's all the same base. One of the things I want to bring up is that you're an Obie Award winner.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's right.
And congratulations on that. And that's and that was for something that was very personal to you, wasn't it? It was The Invisible Hand. You played The
Invisible Hand. Yeah, I played... So Ayad Akhtar is this playwright who wrote Disgraced, and he also wrote The Invisible Hand, and he's a fantastic Pakistani-American writer. And so he wrote this story about a banker who goes to Pakistan, gets kidnapped by this organization who see themselves as revolutionaries, freedom fighters. They don't define themselves as terrorists, or, you know. But they end up kidnapping the wrong guy. They kidnap lower, you know, not as high level sort of bank guy as they thought. And so what happens is my character is this British Pakistani kid with a very thick English accent, right?
Love it.
And he comes in and he's disillusioned with being a minority in the UK and feeling like he's picked on by the police, picked on, you know, just being brown.
Which happens in the UK also, folks.
Absolutely, you know. So he goes to Pakistan looking to be inspired by something. So he joins this organization. They kidnap this guy. And then this guy says, well, look, I don't have $25 million, but I can learn how to work the stock. I can teach you how to take advantage of the stock market so that you can earn my ransom.
Wow.
You know? And basically, it's a great, you know, sort of symbolism of how the West has sort of taught people, you know, to take advantage of capitalism.
Yes.
And, you know, so that in a way that all the things that we think are bad about the other, those are all things that we've actually, as Americans, as Westerners, have put on them, you know. So it's a really fantastic play. I got to play this great role opposite Justin Kirk from Weeds.
Oh, yes, he's a great actor.
Yeah, so the two of us really ripped it up every night on that stage in New York, and it led to me receiving an Obie Award, which was
okay. First of all, how does that even feel? I mean, to to win an award. I mean, because you're in it for the awards, I was in it to act.
It's great to feel. You know what it is? It's you suddenly feel validated that some of your work is being appreciated by people that you respect. You know, the Village Voice does the Obie Awards, and it's an award that is not steeped in glamour. It's steeped in like respectability. Do you know what I mean? And people who get it are oftentimes people who are working very hard and creating something that's meaningful. You know, I mean, that could be said about any award, I suppose.
But I know, but
You know, for me, it was one of the most important ones. You know, that award season, I was nominated for a few others, the Lord Tells and the Drama Leagues, which are also fantastic.
Those are
awards. But to win an Obie was. It was meaningful in a way that, you know, it's hard to put into words.
It's very, for me, it's very New York. It's very New York theater because, I mean, it's off Broadway, but it's still Broadway, so to speak. So it's like, to me, that's one of the top ones you could get.
Yeah. It certainly was for me.
Yeah, in that field.
Yeah, I mean, it meant a lot to me. And again, just being there that night and when they presented the award and going up on the stage and, you know, giving me the opportunity to address my peers and also the press and tell them how important it is that these stories of people of color are being told regardless. And you know, that character for me, what was great was I was able to get that audience to see this guy's perspective. You know what I mean? That what he's doing is logical, even though you might not agree with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like his beliefs are from some sort of experience, you know?
Yeah.
And getting them on my side. By the end of the show, I used to have people, you know, white people come up to me and be like, I was rooting for you, even though I knew I shouldn't be, but I was rooting for you, you know? So
That's gratifying.
Incredibly gratifying, yeah.
I get the sense from you, and almost like what I try to do and all the things that I do,
mm-hmm.
I'm always very conscious. I'm a conscious performer. I'm a conscious mm-hmm. person. I always try to infuse some kind of my truth out in the world. It's like you're the same way, kind of. You're very much about, in some form, you try to sure. work it in there.
I think it's important for me, whatever sort of character I play, that they are built from a place of real honesty and logic. You know, again, because of maybe the way I look, you know, tall, dark, bald head, mm-hmm. kind of severe looking to some people, you know, I get to play these characters who are antagonists oftentimes, you know. And I think it's important to give them a bit of myself, these characters, but also to just make sure that people can see that there's logic and that somebody who's different than you also has a reason for doing the things mm-hmm. that they do, you know? And you may not agree with it, but as long as you understand it, that's what's important.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Now, you also wrote something, well, you wrote a bunch of things, but one of the things you wrote, of course, was based on a true story.
Oh, yeah.
It's my research. Uh-huh. But I find it's for Sketchbook. I find it very interesting. So tell us a little about that.
Oh, gosh. So let me see now. I've written a few.
I'll make you go back in that one. I'll make you go back a little bit.
Oh, yeah. It was based on a conversation I had with someone, like a Facebook argument.
Yes, you know, that's what you said it was.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And where we were talking about mascots and like school mascots. And I guess it was some town in California that had like the angry Arabs or something like that. And none of the people who went to that school were Arab, but they had like this like over the top like guy with a turban and angry eyes and a sword. And there was another school that had like the Indians or something, but it was like you know, this weird sort of mishmash of like Aladdin. I decided to just write this piece about like people confronting each other about this issue, you know, about American sports and allowing. This was also the time when the whole Redskins issue was coming up as well.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, just a lot of my writing with that story and a few others is about, like, perception, right, and how people are perceived based on their ethnicity and how you sort of challenge that, you know, and how you can sort of at least make your audience think about it. I'm not interested in making anyone, change their minds, but mm-hmm. if you're thinking about it,
That's good enough.
That's good enough for me, yeah.
I like that. That's good enough. We're going to show also something, because talk about his diversity. Let's show this Eve Ensler clip a while back.
Vagina, right? So I watch people walking down the street, and I'd be like, in her vagina. Not in her vagina. In her... Oh, like Tina Turner? In, right? Implanted, illuminated, transcendent, right? Oh my God. And you know, you can actually track her career and you can see where she literally like lands in her vagina, right? I mean, she was always in her vagina when she was in her younger years, but when she really landed in her vagina when she was in her 50s, you know, with What's Love Got to Do with It after she left Ike. And it was just like, oh my God. And I would sit in the third row of all of her concerts so that I could sort of just, you know, sort of like just, you know, osmose her living in her vagina into me, you know? Because that is what it looks like. That is what it truly feels like if you are fully incarnated in your body.
I love that.
Isn't that great?
I seriously, when I watched it, I was like, I watched it like three times. I love that because I took away stuff. I was like, oh my God, Tina Turner wasn't her vagina, her 50. Like, she was like into herself. Like, right. She was fully. I get what the point is coming across. Eve Ensler, of course, you guys, vagina monologues. And she's like, Dermot Dermot's stepmother, I think it was. And also, like, he's related to him somehow. So, how'd that come to you? How did you get involved
with
that?
So, that's actually part of a one person show written by Anna Deavere Smith.
We love her.
Right.
Oh, my God.
And it was called Let Me Down Easy. And she toured it all over the country where she played. It's incredible. It's like about 20 characters, I think. And it's about 100 pages. And they're just these lengthy monologues. God. So she toured it for a while all over the country. Eventually, she decided to finally give the rights to allow other people to do it. And so I was the first male to perform this. First person after Anna to perform it professionally, but also the first male.
Wow.
And that was kind of controversial because people were like, well, there's a lot of female roles in there, and what are you saying? But we did it, and it's a fantastic sort of piece on... it's not necessarily on death, but it's about healthcare and about transitioning on to the next life that we live in. And you know, I had the opportunity to play all these characters, and I got to say, it was exhausting because I was only given about 10 or 11 rehearsals to work these 100 pages, 20 characters, everything from like a rodeo riding, you know, cowboy who has... Because a lot of these stories are about people who get injured or hurt, and then either they don't have the health insurance to cover it, you know, and how they went about doing that and what happened to them. There's people who've been, you know, cancer patients. You know, there's at one point I put Lance Armstrong too, you know, dealing with his thing as well. And just being able to like really get... deep into the psychology of all of these characters and to play them one after another. And the show is set up in such a way that you're telling a full story within the outer structure. Do you know what I mean?
Like
from person one all the way to person 20.
There's a story.
There's a beginning, a middle, and an ending. Yeah. And each of them have their own stories as well. So it was exhausting, very, very tiring. But really something I needed to do at one
point.
And
character building.
Yeah, incredible. Incredible building, you know? And being able to like... All right, how do I play a woman without being like, look, I'm playing a woman? Right. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, without mocking it or minimizing it. So that was a really big challenge. And I had a great director, Bonnie Metzger, who's, you know, a force in the sense that she allowed me, she helped make sure I stayed in a place where I was respectful of everything that I was doing. So it never became about, like, clowning or mimicking something, you know?
And the reason why I showed that piece also, some of the other stuff, is that you are having a diverse... experience.
Yeah.
That I want to show other brown people out there that it is possible to have a diverse career.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it takes a lot of work and you certainly have to be committed to it and, you know, not give up. And sometimes it requires also going into avenues that aren't part of the norm, you know? Like, I think sometimes in Los Angeles especially, people are so hell-bent on, like, being on TV that they forget that there's so many other ways to create and be a part of something, be an artist. You know, you don't have to... constantly try to get on a network show. Yes, we would like that.
Yes,
sure, you know, everyone wants that sort of life, I suppose. But it's important, again, I think, when you start, especially, to be an artist first. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you can be an actor or whatever it is. Or you can define yourself that way. But be an artist and know what your art is and what you want to do, and that can shift and change all the time.
Yes,
you know, I can't remember who said this to me once, but it was a long, long time ago. But they said that, you know, we as human beings are porous people. You know, you
can things come in,
things come out. You know what I mean?
I like that.
And you should allow that to happen. So that's certainly how I've sort of tried to live my life, allowing myself to adjust. And, you know, having lived in so many different countries and moving so much, you sort of have to be, you know, malleable in a way. And but yeah, that's I've been lucky that way.
You have been lucky. Now, I ask my guests the same two questions. I never prepped them in advance. But every single guest who's been on the show has answered the same two questions, Usman, okay?
Uh-huh.
So be ready.
Okay.
I'm all about language.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I want to ask you is, what is one word that we should not say anymore?
One word that we shouldn't say anymore?
Yep. Take it out of vocabulary.
One word that we shouldn't say anymore. I would say, oh gosh, that's a tough question.
Make you work for it. You come on the show, you make you work a little bit for it.
You are making
me. Because I just believe that language can hold us back. It can propel us forward. It can move us sideways. I mean, language is a really... I mean, people say words just a word, but some ways it isn't. And what you say to yourself sometimes is equally as important as what you're hearing to prove you to move you forward or change your mood or...
I think... I think language is constantly evolving, and certainly it's important that we don't police it. I'm not saying you're policing it, but you know what I mean? But I suppose one word that's always, like, made me feel a bit uncomfortable is the word colored.
Me too.
Like, not just... And I think people sometimes don't realize why, but it's the idea of colored. You know, like, you are colored a particular way. And growing up in Southern Africa, it had a different, completely different connotation, too, because colored meant people who were half white and half black.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Mixed race and people were called colored, too. So it's one that's always just sort of, like... made me feel good icky, answer. You know? And especially when I was in the South, in Florida, and for grad school, you would hear it quite a lot.
I'm
like,
sure.
They'd be like, well, you know, because you're... And these are like well-meaning liberal people who'd say things like, well, you know, as a colored person, I'm like, well, okay, we need to...
Right.
You know... That being said, you know, I understand, again, that's part of a language of a certain region, and that's, you know, that's an evolving language in that part of the world. But, you know, in terms of, like, that's what they use right now, and maybe they won't, or maybe it's steeped in something that means something to them that doesn't mean something to me. I don't know, but that's been one that's...
I get things like, you know, like, I don't think of you as black.
Yeah.
It's like, what does that mean? Like, to me, it's like, then what do you think black is?
Yeah. Well, why are you denying the fact that I'm black, right?
I'm like, we should look at color. I don't care if you look at color as long as you don't discriminate against it.
You know what I hate is when people say, you know, I don't see color.
Right, I hate that too.
I'm like, then that what you're saying is that I'm invisible. It comes back to that whole point I made about being the invisible minority. You know what I mean?
I thought that before.
I'm like, I'm not saying you should reject the fact that I'm different than you. I think you should accept the fact, embrace the fact that that we're different. We can celebrate the fact that I'm different, you know? But we don't have to, it doesn't have to be something that's completely like, no, I don't see you that way. I see you just like me. I don't want to be seen just like you.
I never thought of that part of it.
I think we should keep our individuality. Oh, yeah, you know what I mean?
Completely.
But just, so.
I like that. Number two, the converse of that, what word do you think we should say more of?
I think we should say the word empathy more.
Oh,
that's been my big thing. I think people should say it, and I should think people should practice it, you know, a bit more, especially in this day and age with the current administration that we live in.
Yes.
I think if you just say it sometimes, it'll remind you to be it. Do you know what I mean? To be empathetic.
I agree with that.
You know, so that's been my big one these days.
So before I could talk to you forever, Usman.
Oh, thank you. I could talk to you forever.
You are just, oh my God.
It's been fun.
You have to come back again.
I will.
You have a million projects. You have to come back again. So as we end this a little bit, I just want to know, are you thinking about going back to any theater soon? I know you're on TV. I know you're busy TV and you're filming TV.
I certainly hope so. I've had a couple of people who've been interested in a few different theaters around the country, and I'd really love to get involved with the right project. And there've been some options. I have this dream of doing Macbeth.
Oh, wow.
And playing Macbeth. Now, this might be a pipe dream, but it's something that I...
Say it out loud. It's going to happen.
I'll put that out in the universe. Yeah. So that would be great. But at the moment, we'll be shooting, you know, season two for most of this year. So it kind of puts me out of the game. And for some of next year as well, for season three.
He's working, folks. I mean, we're happy about that. He's working.
Yeah,
but I just want, because you love theater.
I do. And it's something I certainly want to go back to. Yeah. I'd love to experience some good theater in L.A. I mean, I've done some. I've worked at the Geffen and the Falcon, which is a smaller theater. But I'd love to be able to get involved with something.
There's a lot of great here in L.A. If you guys don't know, there's a lot of great 99 seat theaters and the Greenway Arts. My friends did things over there, or Odyssey Theater. I mean, there's a lot of theaters here that are smaller that are actually putting on interesting. I try to see as many things I can see as I can.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting productions,
from
spoken word solo pieces to actual plays to musicals. I feel like they're trying a little bit here in L.A.
Oh, sure, I think so. I mean, it's there. I know plenty of actors who are involved in the theater scene here, especially like the under 100 seat houses.
It's the 99 seat theaters.
And that's right, 99 seats. And so they're doing it. I think sometimes there's just a lack of funding over here compared to places like Chicago. And there's not that much in theater in general, but over here it seems like it's really underfunded.
It's not as high on the priority list here, because everything is film and TV here.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Where New York, Chicago, places where theater is. Probably even bigger than film and TV.
I would say so.
I think so. Especially New York and Chicago, I think so. Even though film and TV does shoot there too.
Mm-hmm.
Atlanta right now, it's heavily movies and TV there too.
Yeah, I've never been. I've been to Atlanta as a visitor. I've never worked in Atlanta.
Oh, wow, yeah. Everybody, Tyler Perry by down there is working. They're working it out down there.
There's a lot of shows. In fact, in Vancouver, there's a lot of TV.
I know. I was in Vancouver. I do a show here called When Calls the Heart. It's the after show up there. And it's based on that. We were in Vancouver, and and Once Upon a Time's up there. There's a lot of shows in Vancouver.
Yeah.
It's a nice place. I love Vancouver.
Yeah, it's great. It's
so fantastic. Clean.
It is very, very clean.
Oh, my gosh, the subway. Like, the subway, you have to be on the floor.
I know.
It was great talking.
But wasn't it nice to be able to use a subway?
Yes.
Right?
I liked Vancouver a lot, actually. I stayed in the Richmond area. I had some good Chinese food, but I would take the subway in, and it was very nice.
Yeah.
They love their Tim Hortons up there. And
they do.
Isn't that funny?
I had met a Canadian on set here in L.A. who was like, did you go to Tim Hortons? I'm like, all right, I guess I'd really have to go to Tim Hortons. Yeah.
And if you go to Portland, you have to go to Voodoo Donuts. But now they have Voodoo Donuts here at Universal City Walk, so I haven't been there yet to get my maple bacon donut. I'm going to get. So this is Usman Ali. He's right now, you can see him in a series of Unfortunate Events on Netflix. You can see him on Veep coming up. He said probably a few weeks from now, mm-hmm. story is going to come up. That's on HBO. And Nobody's is on TV Land. Mm-hmm. Now, tell me on in that account where they can find you on social media.
Oh, yeah. So on Twitter, Usman Ali, at Usman Ali. Same thing for Instagram, at Usman Ali. And then I'm also on Facebook, but I think it's like Usman Ali 1. I can't remember. You'll find me. Just search in Usman Ali on Facebook. You'll find it. Yep.
Thank you for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was my pleasure.
You guys, so Breaking Into is on Black Hollywood Live, and you can go to our Facebook page and go ahead and like it and see this episode and more information on him on that page. Go ahead and like it and say hi to me while you're there. Also, you can go to iTunes, and we're there actually under Breaking Into under Black Hollywood Live, and we're on YouTube too. So you can find us everywhere and see this episode or my 900 other ones I have on there. Go ahead and watch them and tell me what you think. Tell us what you think about the episode, think about him. I like to read your comments. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next time.
Bye. See ya.
From executives Kevin Undergaro, Dario Kristen, Tiana Hobson, and the entire BHL staff, we would like to thank you for supporting Black Hollywood Live, the first online broadcast network dedicated to African-American entertainment. For questions and comments, contact us. info@blackhollywoodlive.com. Like us on Facebook, tweet us, or Instagram us at BHL Online. And I am the official voice of Black Hollywood Live, Scipio, Instagramming at KingXOBay. Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome back.
The views expressed here are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of BHL or its owners or principals.